24-6068. I apologize. We've got a jurisdictional question as well as what we thought we were here for originally. So, Mr. Hoyt?
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, Scott Hoyt for Appellant Insight. Before I dive in, if I might ask if Your Honors have any questions or issues of concern that I should focus on to start with.
Go for it.
I guess they'll come. They'll hit me as they come.
Yeah, you'll raise questions as you talk.
The district court here recited the proper standard for analyzing this case on summary judgment, but then it failed to apply that standard. It recited that it was required to presume in favor of my client, drawing reasonable inferences from the evidence in its favor on the summary judgment process, but it did not do that. Instead, it relied on immaterial parole evidence to overlook the unambiguous terms of the controlling contracts, the surety bond and the master lease agreement. It did so without making any findings that those expressed terms were ambiguous. And the bond, clearly on its face, says that it pays claimants that have a direct contract with the bond principal, that's ICON, for material, expressly including rental equipment, to be used in the performance of ICON's job on the Air Force Base. Now, it's undisputed here that my client had a contract with ICON. It was the master lease, and that contract was for the modular unit that was being used on the Air Force Base. It was to be leased, continued to be leased, and used on that Air Force Base. And yet, the court relied on immaterial parole evidence to imply or read terms into the bond that aren't there.
Why was it immaterial? Isn't payment on the bond dependent on whether your client supplied materials or labor to the project?
Supply, interestingly enough, Your Honor, the word supply doesn't appear in that bond. And the court read in that to supply, that you have to physically supply, manufacture, deliver, or install in order to qualify. But the bond doesn't say that.
Those bonds aren't always interpreted that way?
No. In fact, we've cited two cases, the Palico case and the Vital Farms case, where almost identical bonds were held to apply. In fact, summary judgment was granted to the claimant in Vital Farms that was a lessor of equipment, did not manufacture it, did not install it, did not deliver it. And the lease, like here, said, I'm not the supplier, the purpose being that they wanted direct warranty claims to the manufacturer. But that case is identical to this one, and yet they held that a finance lease for that equipment in that case qualified under a bond with identical terms here. So no, they're not interpreted to require that you physically have to supply, manufacture, install, or deliver. Those are terms the court read into the bond. They're not there.
Would your argument be the same if you leased to ICON a traditional building, a building that was constructed nearby and was used as the phasing
facility? I'm not sure it would, Your Honor, because that's real estate. I mean, we're talking about a modular unit that was assembled. It's a piece of equipment
they can modular homes or real estate, right?
Right. This was used, I believe, for a dental clinic on the Air Force Base. But
why is that equipment under the...
Well, I'm not saying that my argument would be different. I just hadn't considered that proposition. If it's more on the real estate side, but if it's still leased for use on the Air Force,
The building doesn't look like tools or the sort. It looks different. And
yeah, I don't believe that argument was presented by the bond company in this case. I don't believe they made that argument or that it was presented for the appeal. That somehow this doesn't qualify because it's a modular unit. I don't believe they were made
didn't
that
they,
argument.
Didn't they object that it was the rental of equipment?
Their objection, Your Honor, was that that the finance lease is in essence a loan. So the court held that what you provided was money. You didn't provide anything tangible.
And if that was true, then you wouldn't be able to collect on the bond. Is that correct?
If that were true, and interestingly enough, the cases that they rely on in page 16 of their appellate brief.
You didn't actually answer. You just repeated my question. If that were true, do you agree that you would not be entitled to recovery on the bond?
If it was a straight loan, I agree. And I was pointing out that at page 16 of their brief, recite a bunch of cases that deal with banks and promissory notes and actual loans, so they're really not on point.
Well, if the facts here, if the evidence here showed that this was essentially a loan, then you would lose. Is that correct?
I object to the word essentially in the context we're in now. That would require a factual determination.
Right.
And that's the problem here, that even if you agree that this is susceptible to that interpretation, you don't get to finality on summary judgment on that basis because there's at the very least conflicting parole evidence. We presented a number of parole evidence that is material that was disclosed in the negotiations that they were negotiating for a lease, a finance lease, not a loan. And we provided a UCC filing that said it's a lease and that we have title, and we provided evidence that we were asked to collect the unit at the end as title holder.
The terminology in your agreement can be set aside. The court is not bound by the terminology in your agreement. Is that correct?
No, I disagree, Your Honor. You have to start with the unambiguous terms of the contracts. Ollie v. Rainbow.
This happens all the time. When a contract says this person is an independent contractor, that doesn't bind the IRS is checking to see whether this person is an employee and should have paid Social Security. It doesn't bind the Department of Labor in terms of whether you paid overtime or provided benefits. The terms of the contract do not bind the third party, which is what we have here. You keep insisting on the parole evidence rule. It has no application in this circumstance, does it?
Well, that's the J.R. Fulton case they rely on, Your Honor. That's the only case they cited for that. And
there are a number of cases that say that, and treatises that say third parties are not bound by a parole evidence rule, unless they're successors in interest or something like that.
Well, that leads to some pretty absurd results, that the parties to the contract can't alter their agreement by the parole evidence rule, but a stranger can.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, even if
it's all the time. There are lots of cases.
They only cited one case for it. It dealt with a real estate broker.
If you had done more research, you might have found some cases.
It dealt with a real estate broker agreement where they were trying to determine the time it was signed, not reinterpret the terms. And they said that the parole evidence rule doesn't apply to that.
Do you disagree that when the parties say you're an independent contractor, that binds the IRS and the Department of Labor?
If the contract is between an independent contractor, and I think you have to start with the terminology, and then if there's parole evidence that's material that shows otherwise, you can go to it. But
they don't bother with the terms. Well, I guess it's one factor, but they have like 12 factors. That's hardly dispositive.
Independent contractor, you got to determine where the control lies. That's a question of fact.
Right.
That's a question of fact.
Yeah, and you're not bound by the terminology in the
perhaps,
contract.
Perhaps not, but you have to get there with material parole evidence to show the control.
It's not called parole evidence in this circumstance because the parole evidence rule doesn't apply. Now, I'm not saying you lose, but.
Okay, let's say we're outside the parole evidence rule. The evidence you present has to be admissible. It can't be hearsay. It can't lack foundation. Here we got an affidavit by a guy that after the claim was filed, all of a sudden says, this was a sham loan. And in appellate appendix 819 to 822 in his deposition, I got him to admit, I never used those terms until the NAS attorneys presented me an affidavit that said it was a sham loan.
That's conclusory language anyway. But the court can look at what the substance of the agreement was. And if the court determined that the substance of this agreement was a loan, then you agree that you couldn't collect under the bond. Is that right?
I would agree that if there's a factual determination at the end of the day that that's the case, then you're right. But you can't.
Let's argue. Let me hear why you say this was not really a loan, that it really was a supplying of material.
Okay, there's a master lease that sets out the rent terms, the termination of the rent, that title is with my client. There's a UCC filing that says it's a lease and title is with my client. There's a request by by ICON at the end of the use of the unit that we come get our unit. So no dispute that we're the owner. So it's a purchase lease back. And the fact that they present a witness who signed off on this thing as a master lease without objection and started to pay rent. And then only after the claim is filed with the bond company, because he has an indemnity agreement he has to indemnify the bond company for every dollar paid under the bond. So now all of a sudden, when he's asked to coordinate with the bond provider to get on the same page, he calls it a sham loan. That's the first time we see that.
Let me back up. This building was built for the hospital, and the hospital paid to have it built. Is that correct?
No, ICON built it to provide to the general contractor, United, for use at Vance Air Force Base. Okay. So it was manufactured there. It was then delivered. It was installed. There's no dispute that my client didn't manufacture, install, or deliver it.
So, okay, but when it was built for the specific purpose of using at this hospital. Is that correct?
For the performance of ICON's contract to provide it to United for that.
Who paid for getting it built?
Well, ICON, I believe, initially.
Okay. So all the material and work that was used to build it would be covered by this bond. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And now it's built, and you're saying you're going to be covered under the bond a second time, even though there's nothing more to be built, or, you know, it's already built and it's on site. And now you're going to.
Yeah, now you've got
another arrangement and you're going to cover that by the bond.
Well, now it's being rented with rental fees to be paid initially to ICON, but ICON chose to enter into a finance lease with us whereby we would become the lessor. This all is set forth in the contract, the master lease and the bond. By the way, again, the bond does not require any specific manufacturing, installation, or delivery. It just says a contract for the use of the material in performance of ICON's contract.
After the building was built, did the hospital or the general contractor have to pay any rent for it to be on site until the project was completed?
Yes, the general contractor was initially obligated to pay rent to ICON for it.
And wasn't the facility was built and delivered before you entered into the master lease agreement?
Correct. But again, there's nothing in the bond that says we have to be the provider at the outset. It just says it's a contract for its use. Well, its continued use is use in the performance of ICON subcontract. Here again, that'd be implying a timing element that's not there. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time unless there's any.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, my name is Robert McGreeny. I represent the Appellee and Cross Appellant, North American Specialty Insurance Company. This was a financial transaction, pure and simple. A creative one, but nevertheless a financial transaction that falls well outside the scope of the payment bond that was issued by my client on behalf of ICON.
It would help me.
Yes, sir.
If you went through how this building was built and then who was supposed to pay what and so on.
Absolutely. We have a federal government project accompanied by the name of United Excel Corporation was the prime contractor. ICON was a subcontractor to UEC. ICON and ICON alone designed, fabricated, delivered, and installed these modular buildings.
And then, was it paid for the building? Was there a lump sum that said, okay, you bought this building?
Absolutely. So the way the subcontract worked between UEC and ICON, like most subcontracts, ICON was paid on a percent complete basis as it went through the process of design, fabrication, delivery, and ultimate installation of the modular buildings, what are called the TPFs. There was then a rental component. And so your questions earlier to Mr. Hoyt were right on target. This building had been fully fabricated, delivered, installed, sitting there on the base, ready to earn rental income, and in steps,
okay, well,
inside investments.
Let's say that last step never occurred.
Yes, sir.
And there were rental payments to be made for that building, and those payments weren't made. Would that be covered by the bond?
ICON could make a claim against the Miller Act bond that was posted by UEC and its surety.
Because it was providing material.
That's right. Because it is a true supplier of materials, not a finance company. Really, the timeline...
But then if it sold that building to someone else, the rent would still be due for the building. And that somebody else could collect on the bond if it wasn't paid, that rental. Is that correct?
Not under the facts of this case. I mean, is there a theoretical possibility?
I changed the facts.
Yeah.
So you have the company that built the building. It got paid along the way, and that's being paid rent. And you think that rent, if it weren't paid, the owner of the building could collect under the bond. If the owner of the building then sold that building to someone else and the rent wasn't paid, then that buyer of the building could collect under the bond. Is that right?
I honestly don't believe so, Judge Hartz, and that gets into a question.
You're still supplying material.
I don't know, first of all.
Ownership doesn't matter, does it?
I don't think it matters, and it certainly doesn't matter under the facts.
What matters is whether it's material or not.
Right. And you know, this issue is, as Mr. Hoyt pointed out, we did not get to the point of fully briefing the issue of whether or not a modular building, essentially an office space, is equipment within the meaning of the bond.
Well, isn't that the core question here?
It is one core question for sure, but
if I disagree with you on that Insight is a finance company, if I disagree with you on that,
yes.
Isn't the central question whether the building's equipment or not?
It would be a central question for sure. If you said that this was
if it is equipment, then it's material and would be covered by the bond.
If you said this was a legitimate transaction and not just a finance transaction, I would argue still that, number one, the TPF, the modular buildings, are not equipment within the meaning of the bond and applicable law. And I would still argue that the new owner of the building may not qualify as one of the class of persons who are intended to be protected under a payment bond.
Well, there are two ways in which the owner of the building are getting paid at this point, I gather. One is it's supposed to be paid rent for the building and the use of for this project.
Yes.
But here the problem is that the company that built the building is not making its payments under a lease or whatever with the party it sold the building to.
Well, it's a little more complex than that, Your Honor, as it relates to this specific case, because remember, the building was already built. ICON's money built the building. ICON didn't need anything from Insight except money, all right? The building was there. It was delivered. It was installed. It was ready to earn rental income. There would be absolutely no reason for ICON at that point to what? Go sell its revenue stream? Why would you do that? And the record is very clear why they did that is because they were going broke and they needed operating capital. They'd been kind of working this relationship with Insight Investments. They'd been working this relationship with them for several years, talking about various intricate financing formulas and things of this nature that could help them with cash flow.
And they were supposed to be making payments to Insight. And what you're saying is the payments they were making to Insight were not for material that's already been taken care of.
Absolutely not. And in fact, the way it was originally structured, if you look at the Schedule 1 to the so-called Master Lease Agreement, UEC, the prime contractor on the job, initially was going to just start making rental payments directly to Insight Investments. And what they were doing, Your Honor, is repaying the $410,000 upfront funding that was provided by Insight Investments. You can think of it in that sense. What kind of legitimate sales transaction do you sell something, you get paid, and then you have to pay back the sales price? Because if you look at what's going on and you take this idea that, well, maybe if it was a legitimate transaction, there would be some rental income that's owed from and after a new buyer for the building. You would have had at the point that this bond claim was made only 2 or 3 months worth of rent. And instead, what they did is they accelerated the balance of the lease agreement, because the bottom line was this. They provided $410,000 in upfront funding. That is clear in the record. There are email exchanges days before this master lease agreement was ponied up that make it very clear what we are doing is we are providing upfront funding. We are an equity partner now, an investor with the bonded principal, with Icon Construction. That takes them in out of the class of persons intended to be protected in and of itself, which is really what the district court honed in on. They honed in on two issues, and they are the critical two issues. Did Insight supply labor and materials? And the answer is no. They provided nothing but money. Did Insight fall within the class of persons intended to be protected by this payment bond? And the answer is no. They're a finance company. If I could mention a couple of things that are, I don't think really contested, but I believe are significant. These bonds do not cover banks. They do not cover lenders. They do not cover finance companies. They do not cover equity partners or joint venturers or companies that invest in the bonded principal.
Could you clarify one answer you previously gave?
Yes, sir.
If Insight never came on the scene and United stopped making payments to Icon, would the North American bond cover those failed payments from United to Icon?
If Icon failed to pay, or if UEC failed to pay Icon?
Yes.
No, not the North American bond. Let me be clear about that.
United's.
Yeah, the UEC bond.
Okay.
Yeah, and that actually happened. I mean, the thing that you can't get from the record, although there are actually footnotes all throughout the briefing that Mr. Hoyt and I did, there was so much litigation and still is litigation stemming from this very creative financial arrangement between Insight Investments and Icon. And there were lawsuits, ultimately an arbitration between Icon and UEC. Icon would qualify as a proper Miller Act payment bond claimant against UEC and UEC's surety. Icon can't make a claim on its own bond,
right.
Of course. These folks do not qualify as a legitimate claimant under the Icon bond because they are not a supplier of labor or materials. They are a finance company.
And you do need to explain to me why the, assuming I disagree with you on that, why the facility is not equipment that would be covered by the lease.
Because the term equipment, as used customarily in the construction business, and as I believe it's intended to be used in the bond and in applicable law, is things like scaffolding, cranes, vehicles that might be rented.
Pulling up a mobile home and
yes,
for it, a temporary office. It's a tool, in a sense, for completing the project.
It's a living space. I don't know that it's a tool.
Do you have any cases that involve that situation with a temporary building useful for construction of a project, and whether that, how, if at all, that's covered by a bond? Are there any cases that you know of one way or the other?
There is a case that actually is from, I believe, the Western District of Oklahoma. It is BKJ Solutions, I think, is one of the party. I know it's cited by Mr. Hoyt. We mentioned it as well in our briefing. The issue in that case, unfortunately, is not whether or not a modular building is an item of equipment. The issue in that case is that the prime contractor and its surety were taking the position that the Miller Act bond only applied to actual physical site work on the project. And I believe it was Judge Vicki Miles LaGrange who determined, and quite frankly, correctly determined, that the Miller Act bond itself is not so limited. It doesn't just apply to physical work. It can apply to other types of labor materials actually furnished. But again, these folks didn't provide the TPF. All they provided was money. And what they really want to do here, and why there's been so much focus on the parole evidence rule, is they want to take the position that the surety company is, one, bound by the parole evidence rule, which we're not, and number two, that we're bound by the characterization of the relationship, the label placed on it by ICON and Inside Investments, which is not the case. And this court, in fact, was one of the leading jurisdictions in a case called St. Paul versus, I believe it's H.C. Jones, to say that surety companies on payment bond claims have every right to look into the true nature of the relationship. So there's no question here that the district court did the right thing, and they looked at the true nature of the relationship, and they looked at whether or not there was a real sale and lease back, or was this just a paper transaction? And this was just a paper financial transaction that's not covered under the bond. Let me say briefly, we do have a cross appeal. We did seek attorney's fees. They were denied by the court. I will say very quickly in the last 30 seconds, the outcome of this case, obviously favorable to us, is not determinative of the nature of the action that was initiated against us. 12 OS 936 mandates an award of attorney's fees for the party that prevails in an action to recover for labor and services rendered. That was the nature of their claim, and we prevailed because they didn't provide labor and services. But that doesn't change the basis for which they sought a recovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. You have little time for rebuttal.
Yeah. Let me go back to Runner Hart's, your point about they can challenge the nature of the transaction. Even if that were the case, they haven't cited a single case that says that can be done on summary judgment. Loan versus lease. The cases they've cited all dealt with full evidentiary hearing and factual determinations, not the least of which would be the credibility of the key witness.
Well, if it turns on credibility, you're not getting summary judgment.
Right. And Mr.
That has nothing to do with parole evidence.
Right. But I would submit that Mr. Kale, we presented enough evidence to show his credibility was hugely challenged that I should be allowed to cross-examine him at a trial because he was the key witness calling this a sham loan. So that, at the very least, creates a fact issue, as does the other conflicting evidence. Put aside whether it's parole or not, there was plenty of conflicting evidence that the court was not allowed to make factual determinations on in the summary judgment context. Now, their position would be that that law will not recognize a purchase and lease back as a true lease, and that's just false. A finance lease in the Palico and Vital Farms case of equipment was held to be a true lease, notwithstanding almost identical terms to what we're talking about here. Those are legitimate leases. He says they didn't need us, but they're going broke, but yet they did need us. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, might I address just the attorney's fees issue since that was a cross appeal for 30 seconds?
Okay.
I would just point out the cases they cite for that, there was no dispute that there was a subcontract, a contract for labor and material. The issue was whether the claimant prevailed under that contract. Here, the very issue was they challenged that there wasn't any such contract. And the point is that they also waived it because in all of their pleadings, their final pretrial statement, they stated we are not seeking attorney's fees from Insight because the statute doesn't apply.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Counselor excused. We're going to take a short break.